Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. I'm Matt, and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And this is an Alan Smithy podcast on the web at alansmithypodcast.wordpress.com and available through your iTunes. This week, we're going to be talking about a good movie and a bad movie again. The bad movie is a 1987, probably direct-to-video, terrible attempt at a dark comedy called Funland. And the good movie is a 2000 South Korean film, although I think it had Japanese producers on it, if I recall the correct director, yeah, the credits, called Asako in Ruby Shoes. And well, which one do you want to talk about first? I just finished watching Ruby Shoes.
So did I. So I think that we need to talk about Funland. Before I forget all the wonderful, wonderful things about Funland, because
yeah, there's not that much to talk about. This was not a good bad movie, and this wasn't really a bad movie that was bad enough to be interesting.
Oh,
there's a smattering of interesting things. It stars Squiggy, right, from Lenny and Squiggy, or Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah, but it also stars the heckled husband from Police Academy. Bruce Mailer was in, I think, all six Police Academy movies, and he was the one that I noticed first because, you know,
yeah,
the Laverne and Shirley guy was in makeup for the majority of the film.
Yeah, he plays a clown whose amusement park is taken over by some Italian mob stereotypes. And he goes gradually crazy at the end, going on a sniper shooting. And it sort of sounds like darker. This movie reminded me of Death to Smoochie a little bit, because it's such a like ready-made, prefabricated premise for a supposedly dark comedy where you have just a children's entertainer of any kind, whether it's a clown or a ice cream man or something, who goes crazy. And, I mean, Death to Smoochie was really crude and unfunny and witless, but this is kind of all that on Paxil or something, just really mellowed out.
Now, it has a rating, which kind of surprised me. It's rated PG-13, and that, I mean, when you're watching the opening credits and then you see Jan Hooks' name, mm-hmm. It was kind of strange because she was the only person whose name I actually recognized, even though I'd seen William Wyndham and other stuff. And But seeing her name in it and then how it appeared to be shot like a Saturday Night Live skit.
A lot of medium shots.
And I looked it up, and according to IMDb, it was shot on 35mm, but I don't believe that. It looks like it was shot on half-inch video.
Yeah, it kind of does. Jan Hooks is like only in the first scene, isn't she?
And she's, because she comes back as the sexually harassed secretary who likes being sexually harassed, of course, and her outfits get skimpier throughout. And it's just it's
kind of almost a bright spot. Almost.
Well, the guy has made other stuff, which I didn't. I wouldn't.
Oh,
believe.
Yeah, that's right. The director Michael A. Simpson. Yeah. I looked him up, and I was surprised to see that he directed Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3,
which have their followers.
Which are, you know, campy and funny. Maybe having copious amounts of blood helps the campiness be funnier.
And he also, the last thing he directed was one of the BBC, I think it wasn't actually BBC, one of the British, the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes episodes, which is reasonably respectable, especially for somebody who directed this. And he did work on some British TV movies in the mid-80s, and Dead Aim was, I guess, something else he wrote, and I had always seen that box cover because it was Ed Marino, football guy who went on to Hill Street Blues or whatever, and it had a very you know, lame, late 70s action movie box cover. But I'm trying to, at the beginning of Funland, I actually thought that he was directing a little bit too good for his video, like during that first boardroom scene. But then he got really bad, really, really fast.
Yeah, sort of like he just wanted to get it over with, and that's why everything is in a medium shot. And he's like, "There's no way I can make this." I guess there's one scene I remember when he's all by himself and he's talking to his hand puppet that he talks to through the whole movie, and then the Humphrey Bogart wax statue comes alive.
Yeah,
that scene is handled all right.
Yeah,
for you know, for what it was. It's sort of a little. It was sort of a little too good a moment for the movie, even though it's a really cliched moment to have.
The bogey impersonator is actually pretty good.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah.
So I think that helped it, and then and then when the boss came back from the dead, or whatever, that was
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the worst. It's just the whole thing feels kind of done. Did you ever see Shakes the Clown?
I've seen some of it. I heard that was good.
It's really not, but I mean, it's good compared to Funland. I mean, if you want to see a clown breaking down, the idea of a clown breaking down, the premise itself is just so, you know, lazy. It's and then in this movie, it's like they don't even, you know, I sort of expected maybe like the guy playing the clown would have a lot of, you know, quasi Dennis Leary ranting and raving. And even if it wasn't be funny, even if it wasn't funny, it would at least sort of be high energy. But
no,
David Lander just whines and whines and whines through the whole thing. You really grow to hate the sound of his voice.
And setting him up as being a accountant who had a mental breakdown at some point, it kind of, there was just, he wasn't really positioned as I hesitate to say sympathetic character, but he was annoying as all hell. For most of the movie, and it was impossible to feel sorry for him. And I think they kind of made a mistake by casting Bruce Mahler as the guy to feel sorry for, because that's the only role he's ever played, is the guy to feel sorry for, in, you know, Police Academies and this, even in Friday the 13th 4, when he's the doctor who gets killed at the beginning or whatever. So I sympathized with him, and you're just kind of like, well, you know, you were in Police Academy. Like, this is lower production values than the Police Academy mission to Moscow. And here you are, like, in this set, and you can just tell they're filming an infomercial there tomorrow at the boardroom. And
yeah,
the funniest – actually, I think there is something to talk about when they try and turn it into a teen comedy.
Yeah.
That's something to talk about with the montages introducing where the people are going to go work.
Yeah.
And then...
It's so weird. It becomes Adventureland briefly.
Or summer school.
Yeah.
Except it's a year before summer school, so maybe Carl Reiner saw this and was like... Well, actually, I don't think anybody ever saw Funland. But yeah, it becomes Adventureland.
Yeah.
I love how the inserts don't match where they're shooting. That was nice, like watching it going, hey, they're not anywhere near there. Or the dolphins that kept on popping up. And I kept on
Or the roller coaster. Well, I guess they had a roller coaster because they stuck the actor into
They had that weird scene. What was that? The actor who was making fun of the clown and the respectable actor who played the clown, he's been in other stuff, right?
Yeah, he's done television and stuff for years. Let's see what Dave Lander's been in
He's been in
lately.
General Hospital, man.
He does cartoon voices.
He was on a lot of Lois and Clarks.
He actually has a second career as a voice actor for animation, which is odd considering how whiny and annoying he is. But I guess that's why they want him.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was in. I don't know. It's kind of amazing how many of these people who are soap actors are also in respectable TV shows. For some reason, I've noticed that a lot more since I've been watching some of our finer selections. I'm trying to think who else is in it that come on, there's got to be. Okay, so there's the teen movie aspect of it that is weird. There's the staff photographer. When he gets on the news at the end, that was kind of funny, remember? He grabs the microphone and gets on the news and
Well, yeah, I mean this it, you know, I mean, if this movie had like a few more brain cells, they might have parodied Taxi Driver, or they might have been aware that they were like subconsciously just echoing Taxi Driver. But instead it's just like the clown gets everything he wants 'cause that's what we wanted for him all along, hopefully. And you know, the pacing of this movie, it's like it's hard not to make this movie sound better than it is because this clown doesn't even go on the rampage that's featured on the front of the video box, like with him actually brandishing a gun, until the last half hour. And the whole first hour is, yeah, setting up the park employees. They take an inordinate amount of time giving scenes to the bad guys
Yeah.
who are just kind of. Well, I guess they gave him a lot of screen time because they're bad Italian mobster. And I guess, was that still a popular comedy stereotype in the 80s? Italian mobsters? Because they got a lot of scenes in this, and it just pads and pads until that first hour is over.
Well, yeah, especially the father got a lot of stuff with the dental napkins in his mouth or whatever those things are called that they put in. The dental gauze in his mouth. 87, would it still would have been funny? I don't think so. I mean, but they also had that whole, I think the guy thinks he's very edgy because they did the whole gay director thing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and they did the whole black guy selling watermelon and rapping
Yeah.
in the
Yeah,
80s.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to mention that there was a queen director and some black guys who, well, the joke is that they get hired to work in the concession stand, and then uh-oh, they're all stuck selling watermelon, and
But then they get recycled into the scene where the clown's ordering food for the dead boss.
And they
And
start rapping about burgers and fries.
I think I guess the supporters of Michael A. Simpson sort of see that as his commentary type stuff on the human condition.
Really? You know this?
Well, that's what one of the reviewers on IMDb said, like, who likes him and like hunted down Funland after seeing Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3, that he was edgy comedy.
Yeah, or Fast Food, which is another title that I recognized, though I haven't seen it. It's a 89 direct-to-video comedy. Probably looks exactly like this. Probably looks like it was shot on video, but it's got Jim Varney in it, and
Oh, yeah.
he's a fast food entrepreneur whose secret sauce in his burger stand makes teenagers horny. That's the kind of movie it is.
This is the kind of movie that I feel like wouldn't have been able to get on USA Up All Night because it wouldn't have looked like it was shot on film. Like, quite honestly, they did make sure to at least get stuff that
Yeah.
had production values a little bit too high. But, I mean, this is just.
The other, well, I mean, it's bizarre because the guy's filmography, Michael Simpson, is like the sleepaway camps, Funland, fast food, and then the rest of it is like classy British stuff.
Yeah. And so it's like there's no bio for him that I could find, but I think he must be British, right?
Probably.
So is this his commentary on American culture that
Yeah, sure, why not?
someone might actually see Funland?
Well, you know, that gay director scene we were talking about, like the scene that precedes it or that's part of it is like a bunch of rednecks are watching this floor show where a bunch of guys in black and white and top hats come out, and then I think it's the director comes out and Carmen Miranda get up and he starts singing and stripping and the rednecks are all booing him. Yeah, viewed f through a certain filter, this is a kaleidoscopic satire of American carnival culture and the carnival nature of American culture.
Yeah, my whole problem with that scene though was he was fired. They wouldn't have let him out on stage. There wouldn't have been a show set up for it. It was like, kind of. I mean, that was just another pad. The movie, I guess, supposedly runs 98 minutes, and I'm kind of like, well, they only were able to do that because they filled out so much of it with, the business practices of the smart mobster brother. Was kind of just, that whole thing. And then the sexually harassed female executive who was hired because she was, fresh out of grad school and smart as a whip or whatever the owner says. And then you're like, well, why is he still employing the guy who's, sipping her coffee or whatever? It's just like it felt very much like a skit. And Jan Hooks being in it didn't help. I mean, it felt like the beginning of the. It felt like the whole thing was shot like the establishing shot of an early 90s Saturday Night Live skit.
Well, you know, the guys most had mostly done all that British stuff was mostly TV, so he
Was
wasn't.
mostly TV, but I don't think that they stuck them in medium shots. I mean. I
Yeah,
haven't seen that Sherlock Holmes, but I think it's the one where he fights Moriarty and dies or
huh.
something. The incident at Thor Bridge, maybe, is that one? I don't know. But that sounds like he was outside, and this thing had so few exterior shots. Like.
Yeah, for a movie that takes place at an amusement park or has something to do with an amusement park, a lot of interiors, a lot of boardrooms, a lot of easy to film in boardroom scenes.
I did like how the House of Wax set was obvious, or the exterior establishing shots of the House of Wax was obviously not an amusement park thing. It was just like a house. What else?
Well, how about that ending where like the guy who gets his head sawed off in Friday 4, he takes his little girl away and the park is closing up and she's got a clown mask and it's like, oh no, what if suddenly it's like the end of part 4, Friday the 13th. It's like, oh no, the evil is born again. It's born anew.
Oh no, that wasn't his kid. That was the girl who was lost earlier.
Oh yeah, my
Yeah,
bad.
so I mean, that's just another commentary on how, in America we abandon children and don't
Yeah.
find their parents and put.
Children of traumatic pasts pursue careers in entertainment, and it's a vicious cycle.
That might be in bad taste with Michael Jackson dying. Come on.
Oh, he did? Oh.
Yeah, he died like 5 days ago. Seriously, you didn't know that?
No, I knew that.
Okay. I mean, like, what? We got to be somewhat topical.
Okay.
For when they remake Funland.
The cover of this movie is so scary. It's like a really scary looking clown with a machine gun.
And then the clown in the movie isn't scary at all. Oh, wow. Wow. Wait, hold on. We didn't talk about the introduction to the clown, where he's like mocking the kid with disabilities or
Oh yeah.
whatever. And I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be a kid with disabilities or if he was supposed to be making fun of a dwarf and not knowing that he had disabilities or something, or that he didn't have disabilities. And you just feel like whoever wrote this was like, wow, this is so funny. Like, we're going to make this comment about this and that. And it was, he's kind of like Uwe Boll in that, Postal was like, oh, wow, we're going to make a joke about how we have an action scene where nobody gets killed but kids and it's going to be awful. But somehow it's not funny. Like, somehow the humor part of the social, the commentary on American film doesn't come through.
It's the kind of the movie has the kind of premise, and all of the scenes in the movie are constructed with the premise as the joke. Like, yeah, the clown doesn't know what he's doing with the kid, or the park is run by Italian mobsters, or the clown has a hand puppet who he talks to. And then there's no actual jokes that follow. It's just kind of like these details are thrown in because they're supposed to be irreverent and like convey some kind of mounting insanity in the guy. But it's another part that doesn't work. When he finally does take up a gun, it's not like you feel that he's gradually cracked, even though we've seen him talking to his dead boss and stuff. It's just
Well, my problem with the dead boss is the dead boss is an actual ghost. He's not a hallucination. Because he tells the clown things that only the dead boss would know, like about how he died. So, it adds a layer to Funland.
I hadn't thought about that. I sort of thought, actually, I thought he was just saying that because that's like what the clown would want to hear, would want to think.
Oh, no, I meant the gun in the suitcase.
Oh, right. Yeah,
yeah, the idiotic, like, foam encased, the
cut. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Gun Here's... suitcase thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's some other movie like that where somebody's told the details of how to commit a crime, and you don't know if it's a ghost or not. Maybe I'm thinking of Magic. Like, I don't know. It's a nice ambivalent thing to see in a movie, only this movie was just kind of witless about it. So there's no ambivalency. It's just, oops, he's more of a ghost than a hallucination.
Well, that could bring up, is Humphrey Bogart a ghost, or is he really alive?
It does bring that up because this guy gets visited by actual ghosts whom no one else can see. So that his hand puppet that talks to him through the whole movie, I guess that's alive.
It could be the possibility exists. It did play poker with him, remember? And it, like, nobody else could know about him or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, a lot of the crappy stuff we've been watching, it seems like other people have seen it and that they've gone on to things, or it's somehow informed more recognizable works.
Yeah.
Not Funland.
No, Funland just exists in a void and in a vacuum where nobody's heard of it, and I'm sure we're the first people to podcast about it, and it just exists in a black hole of memory loss. Although, I guess the rights have been well maintained because I was able to watch it on Netflix.
Oh, I think that means the rights weren't well maintained in some ways. I think Netflix is some of the stuff you can watch on Netflix is, you can sell theoretically your movie to Netflix type thing.
Well, I noticed Troma has a ton of their stuff on there, yeah. And I thought, I figured they would have just jumped on the bandwagon and said, like, put all our movies up for free. We need the exposure. And not just the fact that Troma DVDs aren't usually encoded with region protection.
But I don't think that... Are the Trancers type Full Moons up there yet?
I don't know if the Trancers are up there. No, Full Moon stuff isn't. I don't... No, it isn't.
Yeah, so... I don't know. That'd be interesting. We should have looked into the who owns the rights to Funland. For some reason.
So, fat whiny clown Talks to himself, Italian mobsters, really minor establishment of teenagers who work at the park. And it all leads up to him. Here's another weird thing about like how we're supposed to feel about this guy is he's shooting at the bad guys, and he never actually plugs any of them, and then one of the bad guys runs up there to struggle with him, and he ends up shooting him. But then, like, you know, Taxi Driver ending, he gets everything he wanted, he gets cleared. It's, you know, you just hear the reporter saying, like, and in other news, the mobsters have been found out, so they're all going to jail, and it doesn't matter that the clown killed one of them. And the end. Like, who is this movie for? Because, you know, I think Simpson directed this before the sleepaway camps, but if you were wanting to make an outrageous satire of stuff, I mean, there's a lot of dumb movies that try to be outrageous satires, but they're, like, smart enough dumb movies to add a lot of sex and violence. And if this was, well, if it was rated, like, were they going for a PG-13 or not? It's really hard to tell who this movie was aimed at.
Well, when I was watching it, and especially with the indoor sets, I was thinking maybe some conglomerate of, because it was filmed at Atlanta at Six Flags down there, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. Again, from IMDb. Maybe, like, a conglomerate of Atlanta businessmen hired these guys to, like, make a movie because they thought they could turn a profit real quick. And then they hired those Hollywood actors, like the guy from Police Academy and the guy from Laverne and Shirley. And yep. This is what they made was about all I could think. Because there isn't really an audience.
Yeah.
Because it's not violent.
Yeah.
There's no sex. It's not even gross out funny in the late 80s type of way, because that would involve sex. So it's kind of a movie for, I mean, really no one. It running 98 minutes, you couldn't even easily put it on TV.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, but whatever. I think we're close enough to the half-hour mark. If we want to cut off on Funland, we've done our part.
Sure. we've said, yeah, we've again, you know, talked about it as much as we can. But yeah, Funland, don't ever see it. It's not in the least bit remotely entertaining,
but ironic, make someone else watch it
or otherwise.
I think you should make someone else watch it.
Make your enemies watch it.
Be like, this is the best movie. After somebody makes you watch The Dark Knight, like two times on video, just be like, yeah, Funland. It's really good. It's edgy. It's like Taxi Driver, but with clowns. It's better than Taxi Driver. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And if, yeah, make sure they can't press the stop button either. Make sure they're tied up, or they will.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be funny if the DVD for it didn't let you press stop, because, you know, you could program the controls out on DVDs.
Yeah. Okay, that bought a little more time.
Okay, yeah, that's a minute.
That's Funland. So, Asako and Ruby Shoes, I remember when we did our Go to Koreatown episode, which is available on the site and on iTunes. You mentioned this as one of your picks, and I remember you mentioned it because we were talking about how Korean movies and Asian movies in general have a looser idea of showing antisocial behavior, but also, and well, showing all kinds of bad stuff, but also in the way of antisocial behavior. You singled it out because you thought it was so cool that the main character is not just, he's like a loser in sort of realistic ways. Like he haunts the internet, and he subscribes to this webcam girl site, not a pornographic one, but it was kind of like creepy stuff. And you don't see that in American movies too much, and if you do, I think it's sort of like hyper stylized, like the deviancy you see in a Todd Solondz movie. But I remember I was thinking about that as I started watching this, and it's a 2-hour movie. It really the sort of thrust of the plot doesn't even start until about halfway through, and the first hour is mostly setting up this guy. And I was really struck by how sensitive the portrayal was of this. It's about a Korean guy named Yurin, and he's just this lonely government servant, civil servant, and he pines after this punk rock girl who's got red hair. And when he gets the chance, he finds this website that says design your dream girl, and then like we'll make a web girl for you, or we'll hook you up with her, just give us a picture. So because he works as a civil servant, he's got like her DMV picture, and he pastes it onto a body and gives it to the site, and they come up with this girl who we've been seeing, whom we've also been introduced to, although the guy has more screen time. But she lives in Japan. She's a Sako, and she starts she wants to make a – this is very Japanese and very quirky, but it's kind of quirky in an American indie movie way. She wants to make enough money so that she can be between time zones when she commits suicide, so that people won't know which day it happened on. And – also kind of – oh, and she ends up being this girl. And that point doesn't really happen until the first hour is over, that where they kind of connect through the internet like that. The first hour is like setting up their lives separately, and it's very slow and deliberate and sensitive, because it's, you know, it's sort of melancholic. It's humorous sometimes in a melancholic way. Mostly it's just melancholic, but – it's like a good natured melancholy. It's not bleak or nihilistic in its portrayal of kind of ultra alienated young people basically living in an urban area. It's also sort of a caricature of Koreans and Japanese being a Korean Japanese production, and that the Korean guy is obsessed with the internet and the Japanese girl is obsessed with suicide. I thought that was kind of funny.
I think that there's a lot more humor in his story. Sort of in, you know, in the way that it is different, I guess this brings up the whole, I think I've said this on like 2 or 3 episodes before, how after Something About Mary, you know, there's Something About Mary, Ben Stiller, and Something About Mary is portrayed as this kind of stalkerish type guy. He was kind of that character was the hero throughout 1980s Hollywood teen movies, you know, like Secret Admirer and
Can't Buy Me Love.
And Can't Buy Me Love and Better Off Dead and all that kind of thing. And so in Asako, it's a little bit different because he's still kind of he's kind of lovable in a way, and I think the way they get it, making him so, even though he does these creepy things like use the ladies' restroom for absolutely no reason, except that, you know, he's just gonna go in the ladies' room today. Just the depth of what you get to see about the guy's life, that it would be impossible, because so much about him is revealed that you're not questioning whether or not he's a creep. Does that make any sense? Yeah. So, and they really kind of push it in terms of what you get to find out about this guy just through his daily actions. And I think, you know, when he hangs up on his mom, that's kind of a cute type of American comedy scene at the beginning. But her story is...
it's kind of
different.
It's kind of, yeah, it's a little more serious because first of all, she says that she's going to die in the opening narration during the credits. So she's got this kind of omniscient ghostly thing in the first place, and you wonder if she's narrating from beyond the grave. Her home life, I mean, the guy's life is whimsical in a way that you see in American movies sometimes. Like, his lonely life is whimsical in a way that you see in American movies sometimes, like P.T. Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. Except it's not hyper stylized like that. It's, things are revealed through minutia. The girl's life is kind of straightforwardly, dramatic and hard to deal with. Her parents don't get along. She doesn't, relate to her brother or anything. And she's got this best friend who's a wild girl, and she seems kind of jealous of her. Even though they're really good friends, and it's a little more action packed, but driving it all is that she wants to commit suicide, and we never learn why either. She just, her friend asks her why do you want to do it so bad, and she's just like, haven't you ever thought about just doing it, just to do it? So it's a little, it's a little sadder. It's sort of like she's a little bit emotionally dead, as opposed to this guy who is, just isolated. But she sort of seems emotionally dead, and that, she kind of develops later on. She kind of has, she sort of has the arc, and the guy is kind of just the force of nature who's gradually getting closer and closer to intersecting with her life, even though she doesn't know it yet.
And also, I think that because he's, wealthy, which is implied a couple times, and she's not, so it seems like that's not part of his conflict, whereas hers, that's an issue. And I think that there's so much subtlety in her story where you don't really know what's going on, like with the father and the mother. It's never really defined, because did the father lose his job? Because remember, she saw him crying on the subway platform, and I felt like he'd lost his job and that kind of thing. And that's never really explained. It's also never really explained what goes on at the club where the girl works, her friend. I mean, yes, they're just a girl group, but is there anything more to it? Kind of seems like there might be. And with him, everything is sort of a little bit more defined, and his arc is,
we get to know him better. There's something about the girl which is, distancing as part of her nature, and then even the details of her life are kind of kept secret from us. She doesn't get to know what's going on around her, and neither do we.
Yeah, there's something I want to talk about, but I'm kind of worried about mentioning it because it's kind of a spoiler. I guess we'll skip it.
How about just, if anybody... pause this and go see the movie. It's good. You should see it. And then come back right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so spoiler alerts.
Right now. The pills thing. It's kind of implied she actually is dying. It's never clear what's wrong with her, if anything.
Yeah, I didn't think there was anything wrong with her.
She's taking tons of pills.
Yeah, I thought that was just like repeated suicide attempts. That's what she does. Is
antidepressants?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, she gulps a bunch of pills like at random when she finds out she's lost her money. Towards the end.
No, that was a suicide attempt. But before, when she was gulping the pills, she was saving all those pills that her mother tried to make her take.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I kind of always saw it as that she was, like, sick. Like, even when I've seen it before, but it's been years. So I thought that she was sick and then found out she wasn't or something. That's just another one of the things that he doesn't really explain about her. Whereas with the guy, he's so boring in a way that there isn't anything going on. He likes this girl, so he, talks to her sometimes and waits for her sometimes and lies to, or actually, I think that scene where his coworker sees him and says, "What are you doing tonight?" Oh no, he didn't know what was going on because his brother, the whole brother-in-law relationship is really cool, and I think most of that's in the first hour, and it's kind of amazing how they keep this 2-hour movie going without any sort of forward momentum. The guy's story until the internet girl shows up is really one of the most non sort of epical character studies you can think of, because it's just, he just goes to work and there's the whole thing of, well, I guess his thing, much like her stuff, is he has that numb finger, and that's never really explained. And for a long time after I saw the movie, I thought there was like a longer director's cut or something
Or that would be explained.
where that would be explained, where his coworker's neck injury would be explained, but I think the coworker was just a hypochondriac who pulled his neck when he fell over in the street trying to catch the cat. I think another thing about this one is sometimes Korean movies, when they discuss the civil service stuff, they're sort of talking to the familiar Korean audience. Whereas I think with this one, even though it's more of a drama than anything else, it humorizes them enough that any audience can understand what's going on in this situation. It's not a specialized joke when he's being the sort of put upon civil servant.
Having to catch a cat and whatnot.
And then the girl who refuses to admit she'd messed up her garbage. And then later on, when that sort of pops up again, and it's just a really weird sort of throwaway scene, and I think that's one of the things that struck me about this movie the first time I saw it, was is it's filled with these characters, especially him. He is not the most interesting thing going on in the world around him.
No, his story is sort of fill instead of being filled with strong and kind of sad figures like the girls is, he's surrounded by, wackiness or something closer to it anyways. Like he's got that coworker who's really obnoxious, and he's got his brother who has the cute little niece who, comes up and asks what he's looking at on the website. He's got the people who don't take out their garbage correctly. I mean he could sort of sustain like a slice of life story by himself. You can kind of, and sometimes you see movies like that, but where this movie is really smart is in saying like, I'm going to connect these two characters. It's a story of serendipity, but the serendipity is going to happen through technology and just co coincidence. And then one more spoiler alert, like at the end when they meet and it's a happy ending, it's like you couldn't have done a story where it just otherwise where it kind of builds up to the climax and then at the climax it just stops. I think the American version of this would have the internet thing happen in the first 15 minutes, and then they would meet at like the 1 hour mark, and it would be 90 minutes long.
Well, the American thing would also have the ending where the yes, they meet, but oh no, he has the thing with some other girl, and then they have to get back together again. And what's really crazy about it that would never happen in an American movie is a couple things, both spoilers, so don't listen, just go see the movie now, somehow. Just buy it. I mean, really, that's what I did. I mean, you know, it's worth it. It's probably like $9 imported. There's the whole thing where he goes to Japan for a while.
Yeah.
That isn't really defined, isn't really explained. Apparently, he's getting a new apartment back in Korea. He just goes to Japan.
And he's with that old childhood friend, right? The red-haired childhood friend.
Do you think she? I thought that no, that her whole thing was in Korea. She was trying to establish Chinatown in Korea. I think after his apartment flooded, he just went off to Japan because he was getting a new apartment. His mom was getting him a new apartment. And so he just went to the travel agency and went over to Japan for a second.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they see each other in the subway station.
They see each other in the subway station. You're like, oh, that's crazy. You know, how serendipitous. You know, big Hollywood moment. Not at all done here. But then even, you know, more so that I can't believe they weren't able to sell this to Hollywood to remake it, was when you find out that no, they've been running into each other for years.
Yeah, that was a great revelation.
And you're just kind of like, this is really... And the thing I love about this guy's movies, and Asako really has a lot... His first movie was called An Affair. Same guy was in it. And same kind of drama tone to a lot of it. And I haven't seen his other two movies. The next one was a period piece based on... Dangerous Liaisons, but in sort of feudal Korea. And then his latest one was called Decepo Naughty Girls, which was based on, I think, a manga or something. I have both of them. I just haven't gotten around to watching them. But Asako has, like, it doesn't really have false endings, but it kind of has the where you could see...
It's got several great false endings, like in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Which I don't even want to talk about because
it's kind of like when you watch them,
they're so brief and they're so rewarding.
Yeah, and he keeps on pushing it,
holding
to the
her
right
breath.
Ending. Yeah,
and the screen going black. That's fantastic.
He keeps on pushing it to the right ending, which it kind of. I think the only other movie I've seen that really does that as well as Broadway Danny Rose, where it's got so many endings and then he finally gets, you know, pays off for all, and all of them are rewarding, but the last one is just really something you weren't expecting at all. And sort of this profound observation. And what's really kind of weird about Asako is that there's, and I didn't realize this the first time I watched it, in terms of the Korea-Japan sort of cultural relationship, she has all those horoscopes and premonitions, and all of them point to Korea and him, and it never occurs to her that it's not a Japanese, it's not, you know, there's the scene where she reads the thing and a man from the West will come into her life, and she thinks about, you know, is it Kyoto, and well, no, because, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm kind of like, well, no, because South Korea is west of there. And the other thing is that I don't think that, especially in an American film, and I think any Western film, because I don't think, you know, I'm thinking about French romantic dramas, and I don't think they could have gotten away from it. It's never implied that these two people are going to end up together in the first, at their introduction. I mean, their storylines could be totally just, you know, separate juxtapositions that they never meet.
And, yeah, it's not like Shop Around the Corner.
Right.
You've got mail. It's this movie sort of like, because Shop Around the Corner, You've Got Mail is people who know each other in real life but don't know each other through letters, and they fall in love through letters, and you know, it was done via the mail in the 40s, it was done via email in the 90s, well, you know, just 2 years before this movie. And then this movie kind of, like, I'm always impressed how much more savvy Asian film is about the ways in which technology impacts people's lives and, like, the effects that it has on societal isolation and the way people think about love and relationships. Like, it's very savvy, and this is sort of the movie that takes that shop around the corner premise to the breaking point of, you know, totally minimal contact, not knowing who two people not knowing who each other are and still falling in love. And that's only possible to take it that far because of the way, you know, technology is. I mean, and making a, you know, you could sort of, it's sort of easy to imagine now in 2009 that, you know, Hollywood will get around to making a movie where a guy falls in love with a webcam girl, and then, but she would have to be like, she probably, you know, she couldn't be halfway around the world, because then you can't have the two stars together if you're not willing to do that. And, you know, making a webcam girl romance story or whatever in 2000 is pretty savvy as well. And yeah, I was really impressed. It's not, you know, it's the best, it's the most modern in the best way take you could do on that sort of story. The two people who love each other but don't know each other. And actually the girl doesn't even love him.
No. even though he's
contacted her and he keeps trying to contact her, she just doesn't know, so she doesn't care. She's completely off in her own little world.
And I think that at the end, another spoiler alert, they end up in Alaska.
Yep.
And what's kind of, and I'm guessing it wasn't shot in Alaska. Maybe it was. I don't know. No, I mean, it obviously wasn't, but maybe it was shot in New Zealand or something. There's the implication that the two of them, we miss the most important scene between the two of them where they connect because they're foreigners in Alaska.
Yeah.
We miss that scene. We miss the scene where they fall in love.
Yeah. Yeah, that should have been the climax, and that's the end.
Yeah, and we don't even get to see that. We get instead this really weird little, really kind of touching moment at the end, and then some really cool sound. I don't know if you noticed, but one of them talks through the right speaker, and the other one talks through the left.
Yeah. Got that.
And this was not a hit. This was a kind of would have been at the start of the sort of South Korean renaissance that we talked about in the old episode, but this was a bomb, which I couldn't believe after I saw it. And it was not at all a success in box office. And of course, since it's Korean and it's not an action movie or a horror movie, it has not been released on domestic US DVD.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I wonder if it did better in Japan or in South Korea, or if it was released in more theaters in either one.
It actually, in a lot of ways, well, that's kind of the thing. When I saw it, I was watching a lot of both, because Netflix was still around, so uh-huh. I was able to get Japanese movies with subtitles, and it felt a lot, I mean, that's the thing, is his story feels like sort of
a Korean movie,
but an elongated one where there isn't a second or third act. There's just a really long first act. Whereas her story of this sort of her story was very much like a Japanese family drama. Mm-hmm. Because all of those are complete and utter downers, where it usually ends with one person running out on the family after realizing
and a suicide.
And then, we haven't even talked about just that there are certain things in this you couldn't remake in an American movie. Kind of like how, when they remade Insomnia.
Yeah.
They left out the part where the detective gropes the teenage witness. And I was kind of like watching the original. I'm like, there's no way they did this in the new one. And they didn't. In this one, there's, you know, the brother is proud of his sister for taking her clothes off on the internet.
Yeah, that was so weird the
I mean,
way
it was just like.
you watch the way you watch her realize that he knows.
And then he's proud. And you're just like, whoa. And
Yeah.
then also the. Where the niece touches his leg while he's looking at the porn site. And you're
Yeah.
just kind of like. And the closest I actually think that in some ways American film has gotten to this was at the beginning of Superbad, where they talked about this, you know, and at least acknowledged it. And I don't think that a lot of mainstream American movies even acknowledge it because
Acknowledge what?
adult websites.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, there's as you're saying that, I was thinking of the scene. I think it was like maybe one or two scenes earlier or later, but he's the red-haired girl in the punk band who he's got the crush on comes back to take her ID photo again, and he cuts out her head, and then he puts her head onto a web girl model's body, and he
Yeah.
jerks off to it. I guess it would be in an Amer I guess it, like it would be in an American Pie type movie if it were played for laughs, but it's the fact that it isn't played for laughs that makes it something else
And
and
this is
makes it.
this, yeah, and this is another scene where if you're listening to this and ignoring us telling you to just go watch the movie instead of listen to the spoilers, this is an endearing scene.
Yeah, it's endearing. It's
I
because you don't have that much else to go off of with this guy, so like the little ways that he steals away pleasure into his really boring life become your become how you're ingratiated to him.
and I think the sort of urban isolationism of this, it's this forced sort of the loneliness of it's not something that you see a lot in American movies. Sort of hyper stylized to tie it into Funland would be Taxi Driver is always the
Yeah.
example that this is the urban whatever, and they're usually cop movies that do this. Something in like Sea of Love is all about how New York sucks and it drives people crazy, but the whole thing of how even in a big city filled with millions of people, people are alone. That's a very sort of classical Edgar Allan Poe observation, you know, late 1800s industrialization observation about the human condition. And you don't see that in Hollywood movies because they're about creating a sort of a idealized urban environment, even if they're trying to be Goodfellas, or not Goodfellas, but Taxi Driver in some ways.
Yeah, well, like the romantic myth that if you're in a big city, there's someone else in that big city who's just as lonely. I mean, that works good for Hollywood movies because you can have, well, you have them meet and then you have them not be in love and then eventually they are in love. But Asako is so funny about that, like that the its approach to that romantic myth because it says, yeah, there is someone out there. It's just that. They're on the other side of the planet, and they have no idea that you exist. But you know, through sheer luck, you know, don't give out hope because if it's, you know, things that are meant to happen will happen, and that's like the only reason that she and he even finally meet up because it was meant to happen.
And that's a very kind of Hollywoody ending, but not played in a Hollywoody way in a movie without any other Hollywoody moments. It's very weird, especially after you see the guy's first movie, after you see an affair where he doesn't give the audience the payoff, which doesn't spoil anything because I didn't explain what it's about. But he doesn't give the audience the payoff. There's the possibility of the payoff. but it's not like Asako where you get this kind of just, you know, really nice payoff because you've spent 2 hours caring about these people.
Right.
And I'm trying to think. I don't... And the cat, how cats are in it, and they're kind of back and forth between places. There's a lot of... I imagine this is all deliberate, not symbolism, but deliberate motifs, but it's hard to pay attention to all that because just the stuff going on is so compelling.
Yeah, it's sort of like metaphysically stylized, but realistically in terms of what happens to the characters, it all unfolds in such a naturalistic slice of life way that you don't see the happy Hollywood ending coming, and then when it does, it's a dream come true because you weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
And like we were saying about Korean movies in general, it's sort of, you know, there's like a big bifurcated tonal shift at some point. Well, I don't know if that really happens tonally, but at least, you know, I just thought it was really cool and interesting how it's 2 hours and the two main characters share the movie and they don't even hear of each other until halfway through, and then they don't meet each other until the last, you know, 120 seconds or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what else is an example of like a movie that goes too far in stylization to depict the loneliness of a supposedly normal person? 1 hour Photo. That's supposed to be where it's like, a lot of movie directors seem to think that like anybody who, if you have an ordinary job and you're isolated from everyone else and you live by yourself, then the only way your story can be interesting is if you're a psycho killer.
Right. And,
so this movie was much more sensitive than that. That was nice.
I think that that's kind of an American preoccupation. And I think that they do that, we do that because we think it'll sell tickets or it'll get Robin Williams to sign on to be in our movie. Because the British, I think that, you know, in Korean film, Japanese film, probably French, but they don't subtitle their DVDs because they're jerks, so it's hard to really know. And definitely British, they don't really sort of condemn's too strong a word, but they don't, being a regular person in fiction, in film fiction in those places isn't like it is here, where, you know, everybody has to be extraordinary in the American sort of film. And even if it's an American independent film, the guy has to either be a criminal or a secretly a great film director who hasn't been discovered yet, or like a musician or something.
Yeah. I mean, or his depression is just hilarious and he has all kinds of funny things to say about the meaninglessness of his life and his job and his bad relationship and stuff.
So it's very different, and I think Korean film in general just sort of plays that differently, especially what's that one I was thinking, Windstruck, which is a romantic comedy, and it's a, I think the main character is a cop, but it's, you don't have any of the standard American cop movie tropes. So I think
there's maybe we should do this in the future, but there's a great Chinese movie called Crazy in the City about some cops, and it's like a going into business story about people who become cops, and it completely, or one girl who becomes a cop, and it totally changes her life, and it's like, it's got this really positive view of the police, which is kind of hilarious. But
yeah, we should do that.
Do more Korean movies too in the future, but I think that does it for Asako.
Yeah, because everybody should have turned this off 25 minutes ago to go
exactly
from YesAsia.com. I'm sure. Still has some really cheap copies.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well,
Okay.
next week it's going to be a treat. I'm really looking forward to this. We're going to be talking about two John Carpenter movies. Well, one's a movie and one's a short, and they're both kind of lost. Elvis is 1979 made for TV movie starring Kurt Russell, and it was their first time working together. It's a total of 2.5 hours, so I guess it was probably spread out over 2 nights. The other is The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, which is an Academy Award-winning short film he directed at USC in 1970 or 71, I think. And, I really don't know what to expect from either of these, especially not Resurrection of Bronco Billy, it being a student film of his, but these are kind of, hard to find gems for John Carpenter fans, and we will be going into both of them with guns blazing.
So we'll be kind of keeping the format of two movies per episode, but not a bad and a good. The other thing is, the last time we did a John Carpenter episode, he signed on to direct at least one movie, maybe
Oh
two,
yeah,
remember?
and then
So.
it changed around, and it's currently going to be some kind of supernatural thriller. And before that, it's I just noticed on IMDb like he's got four movies, three of them are announced. The one in production is the supernatural thriller type thing,
So he's
but
not doing the Nicolas Cage one?
no, supposedly that's going to be the next one after this one. He's like Clint Eastwood. He's got about three or four movies he wants to do before he dies.
Except he's like 30 years younger than Clint Eastwood and looks 30 years older.
Man,
But hopefully, what I'm hoping.
Michael Jackson was only 50,
That's true. What I'm hoping is that maybe he'll get something good in production, through the karma of the Alan Smithy podcast once again. With Kurt Russell, perhaps. Hey, Jack, what's his face, is ready for a comeback. What was that guy's name?
Jack Burton.
Jack Burton's ready for a comeback.
China is here, Mr. Burton. What
And
does that mean, China is here? I don't even know what that
I have
means.
that in HD. I think I'm gonna watch that Friday. I haven't seen
Sweet.
it in 10 years.
What? Oh, yeah, 10 years. Awesome. It's
Yeah,
going to
I
be
can't
great.
wait.
Going to be great. So, yes, join us for John Carpenter geekery on the next Alan Smithy podcast. Check out our WordPress blog, alansmithypodcast.com. WordPress.com. And thanks for listening. This has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.